the latest U.S. employment report adding to the sharp pains being felt this week in the bond market. The U.S. jobless rate dropped to 3.7%. You have to go back 49 years for a rate that low. But as the labor market continues to tighten, wage growth is still being constrained. Average hourly earnings rose by only 8 cents last month, bringing the average year-over-year pay raise to 73 cents.
Remember that gold panner who found the largest golden nugget in Scottish waters in 500 years? Well, miners in Australia say they've topped that by finding the biggest gold nugget in history. According to media reports, in September, miners unearthed a 200-pound gold rock while working in the Beta Hunt gold mine in Western Australia. Now, at current prices, the gold-encrusted rock is worth around $2.6 million.
General Motors getting some help in the race to get a self-driving car in the market. Wednesday, announcing Honda will fork over $2 billion for a stake in Cruise, GM's self-driving unit. The investment underscoring how costly it is for automakers to work on an emerging technology that has yet to prove itself. GM gets this cash infusion on top of the $2.25 billion Japan's SoftBank already agreed to invest. For its part, Honda, which has been slow to the self-driving market, gets to hitch its wagon to a company that already has a head start.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Monday. It's October the 8th, 2018. And it's 5:11 in the morning. Thanks for being with us here on another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. We appreciate you tuning in. Lots on the program today. Of course, it's Monday. That means CEO Spotlight Monday. And the CEO of Assure is here. Chris Shivink is here, the CEO of Assure. She's waiting in the PPG Paints green room for our interview. We'll get into what's new at Assure. And why they're trying to conquer the boardroom after they've tried to and really have conquered the music stage. That'll be in our first segment this morning. And in our second segment, look at the business of men's grooming. It is big business these days, and that's coming up at 5:40 this morning with a local angle to that. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk with futures pointing toward opening losses on Wall Street later this morning. It is not a holiday for the stock market and only the bond market in the United States. Dow futures are down 81 points at 26,40.11. The S&P and NASDAQ down by about a quarter to a third each. Around the globe this morning in Asia, market's going to end the day lower as well, with the Nikkei off nearly three quarters, 191 points. The Hang Seng down nearly 370 points, more than a percent and a half, nearly a percent and a half. And the Shanghai off 104 points, that's down about 3%. In Europe, markets generally lower as well, with the FTSE, the DAX, and the CAC lower by about a third to a little bit more than a half a percent. And oil is trading at $73.58 a barrel, which is down 76 cents. A couple of stories before we begin this morning. The Nobel Prize for Economics goes to two researchers at American universities, Yale University's William Nordhaus, was named for integrating climate change into long-term macroeconomic analysis, and New York University's Paul Romer was awarded for factoring technological innovation into macroeconomics. They will share the $1 million prize, again, the Nobel Prize for Economics. Also, this morning, a report on gas prices shows that regular gasoline has spiked nearly 7 cents a gallon over the past 2 weeks, costing nearly $2.97 a gallon. Industry analyst Trilby Lundberg of the Lundberg Survey says that's 41 cents a gallon higher than at this time last year. Lundberg says that rising crude oil prices are the main reason for the increase at the pump. The highest average price was about $3.82 in Los Angeles. The lowest was $2.58 in Houston. The average diesel price rose 7 cents over the last 2 weeks at $3.28 a gallon. We begin front and center this morning with our CEO Spotlight. Microphone maker Shure has dominated the music stage for nearly 92 years, and now it wants to take over the boardroom as well. It has a groundbreaking new audio conferencing gear, and that's fueling growth at the company. Shure's CEO, Christine Chivink, is here this morning to talk about that. Christine, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's very exciting to have you because you've brought a lot of props today from the museum. Rich history at Shure, lots of years of products and excitement and technology. Give us a sense of where you're at as a company, where you've been, where you may be going.
Mm-hmm. Well, Shure has been around since it was founded by Sidney and Shure in 1925. So we are 93 years plus. And currently, we are attacking three different markets globally. So we have our core business that we've had with microphones for the decades since 1925. So professionals, if you go to a concert, if you're looking at somebody on stage, if you go to a hotel room for a conference, you're going to see Shure microphones employed there. So that is part of our core business, serving the professionals that help deliver sound to all these different venues around the world. Secondly, we're approaching more of a consumer market. So we have products where music makers are trying to, you know, do their own sort of music creation in their rooms, in their garages, what have you, and people that want to do listening of their music. We've been targeting, for example, recently the urban commuter, you know, on their ride to work who wants to listen to music and be a little bit isolated from everything happening around them. And we have really premium listening products, headphones and earphones. And our third component would be probably our fastest growing one at the time, which is hitting, you know, boardrooms, conference rooms. People increasingly are doing work remotely, need to be communicating with people in Asia, in Europe, in other parts of the country. So our conferencing business, whether it's a microphone on a table or something that's even more unobtrusive, say up in a ceiling, are products that help people communicate in business. And that is a really fast growing part of our business right now.
You've been at Shure for 30 years almost, right?
Almost 30, approaching 30.
You've described a business that's gone from one end to the other. Give us a sense of, you know, your bird's eye view of that over those years.
You know, in 3 decades, I can tell you I have seen an incredible change, and the biggest change have come in how global Shure's footprint has become. I started in 1989 as a quality engineer and worked a lot with our manufacturing that was going on. At the time, we were headquartered in Evanston, had a lot of products being made there. And we had 5 locations all in North America. We had a couple of factories in Mexico, and everything else was up in the Chicagoland area. Fast forward to present day, we have 30 different locations around the world. And a lot of those end up being go-to-market offices. So not just so focused on manufacturing like when I started with the company, but really trying to get closer in touch with customers. The way that people maybe use our products in China or in different parts of Europe is different than what we do in the U.S. I would say we had more of an exporter mentality. When I started with the company, we would make great products for the domestic market and then ship internationally. And by the way, we were ahead of our time on that. But we really didn't have a good feel for the markets and being shoulder to shoulder with different users in different parts of the world. So now having sales offices anywhere from Dubai to Sao Paulo to South Korea really helps us get in touch with the differences that do exist around the world.
I'm going to get into some of the different technology that you've talked about, but I want to ask more about the global part of that because it is really intriguing. How are the markets different? Like, for instance, in the UK or Europe, in the European Union, mm-hmm. How is it different from the United States?
You know, conventions really do differ. So let's take our core business of professional audio and music and bands that are playing around the world. So you're going to see a lot of similarities between the UK and the US and even into Japan. A lot of the Western bands are very popular, and they tour around different parts of the world. It's interesting to go to China, where, you know, rock and roll is still a little bit on the emerging side, and traditional groups are still quite popular with traditional Chinese instruments. So a lot of times, the same kind of microphones, amplification that is needed for a rock and roll kind of show is not needed for traditional Chinese instruments. So we have to adapt and modify how we're approaching the market for different parts of the world.
I read a fascinating story about how in the UK you've been miking up the soccer stadiums so that the people who are listening or watching those broadcasts or listening to them get a full sense of what it sounds like to be actually there. Give us a sense of not only the size and scope of that, but why that's pretty cool.
Well, you know, sports is interesting. That is something that is seeing, our products are seeing some new lights in not just soccer arenas, but say NFL. So we have microphones that have been placed under, like, you know, base plates in baseball. We have microphones that have been put on referees for the NFL. And that gives you that true, like, in-the-game sort of experience. So lots of different challenges with those kind of products. You know, if you're miking up a player, you're miking up a ref, that's going to get that product is going to get a lot of abuse. And fortunately, our products, being known for being so rugged and reliable, we can do those kind of applications, you know, maybe a little bit better than others can.
Yeah, the reliable, rugged part of that, I remember as a young broadcast journalist, we would some of the microphones we would have, and I think you brought one of them today. We were always told, "Hey, if you ever need to hammer something in, you could use this microphone for that." I never did, but they've always been rugged, always been good for not only electronic news gathering but other stuff as well.
Truly known for that, and a lot of that actually stems out of the fact that Shure became a wartime provider in around 1941. So we were making microphones at that point; had been doing microphones since about 1938, and when we became a wartime provider, of course, we had to meet the demands of products being out in the field. Extreme, you know, conditions around temperature, humidity, wind. When I started with the company as a quality engineer in 1989, I saw this abbreviation in capital letters, MIL-STD, military standard. Mm. So even in 1989, we were still using military standards to test our products, which, you know, that was something that Mr. Shure believed in coming out of the war. Our products were rugged, reliable. Why would we treat any other consumer any differently than what we had been doing for the military? So a lot of those kind of tests for humidity, for temperature, drop testing, vibration, we still employ a lot of those tests today. And I learned really quickly what a military standard was back in 1989.
And small, too. It's everything is small now these days.
Mm-hmm.
You've brought in a wireless microphone setup that is so small. It looks like, I mean, it's just very tiny. And this is the standard now. When you watch a play on Broadway or you see something on television, you don't even notice that there's a microphone on the person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, electronics in general continue to get smaller and smaller. So when you're looking at, like you're describing, somebody on stage, an actor, they're going to have a costume on, and we want them to generally be, the producers want them to be wireless so they can move around freely. So they're going to have a body pack, which is small and miniature, as you saw, placed somewhere under their costume. And then the microphone element itself also has to be micro miniature. So we have a new 5mm form factor microphone that literally will get taped on the head or under a wig of an actor. And I mean, if you think being out in wind and high humidity is a difficult environment for a microphone, actually being on stage is even worse. The makeup, human sweat has a lot of chemicals in it, which are extremely abusive and corrosive. And that sort of environment is about as difficult as a microphone can make its way through.
I want to talk about the cool current thing that Shure is working on. We've all been in a conference room where we've had trouble communicating, where there's been the mics are giant or the whatever is just none of it's functional. Mm-hmm. This new conference room that you guys have put together is just phenomenal. With the mics in the ceiling. Describe this for us and give us a sense of how this came to be.
So we call that an array microphone. So the one that you're describing does fit into a standard drop ceiling where you see ceiling tiles like the room that we're sitting in right now. You would just drop in our microphone array instead of a ceiling tile, and you'd have 120 plus microphone elements working for you. Very software controlled. That's another big change that I've seen with the company in 3 decades. I couldn't even imagine 3 decades ago what a software engineer would do at Shure. And now we have more software engineers at the company than we do any other kind of engineer. So we've been working on this sort of holy grail of microphones, getting the microphones off of the table for a couple of decades, and a lot of different companies have been as well. We perfected it finally 2-3 years ago, launched the product into the market, and it's taking off. Because you're right, people walk in and they try to start that meeting and you get the old, can you hear me now thing happening, and it's so frustrating. And we have some information from some of the trade groups that we belong to that say that on average, it takes a call or a meeting like that 12 minutes to get set up. Very frustrating as people are trying to get down to business. But What you eliminate by putting the microphone up in the ceiling is you can clear the table and you don't get a lot of that background noise. You're going to have people rustling around papers all the time or shuffling things around, twiddling with their phone, whatever the case is. So by putting the microphone in the ceiling, you can reject a lot of that noise happening at the tabletop level.
I've heard people talk about this, that every voice in the room is picked up with clarity that you would never suspect. What's the magic behind that? Does it go back to the software part of that?
It does, because it goes back to both software and then also our expertise in DSP, digital signal processing. You know, we had the knowledge of transducers. We've had that since the 1930s. But it really wasn't until we were able to also marry up software to control. You know, how do you handle a microphone that's up in the ceiling physically? You need to have software to control it and to have the proper signal processing to make sure that things like echo cancellation is employed, that, you know, the right kind of mixing is going on. All of that is happening behind the scenes. Without those things, the transducers themselves, the microphones themselves, aren't going to get the job done.
From a market standpoint, every company in the world has a boardroom, has a conference room. That's a pretty good market that you're opening up there. I'm guessing that's the goal, right?
It absolutely is the goal. And, you know, we started selling these products now just a couple of years ago. And what's been really interesting for us is there's always, you know, there's a whole layer of professionals that make these decisions that outfit companies that have all these boardrooms and meeting rooms around the world. So, you know, we were used to dealing with AV professionals. Increasingly in companies, those decisions are being made by the IT professionals. So we're establishing a whole new set of relationships and working a little bit directly with the corporations through, of course, the layer of people that help us get those products installed, the architects, the consultants, and so on that help outfit these kind of rooms. So we're setting up a whole new set of relationships that we didn't even have a decade ago.
Tenure as CEO, obviously this conference room's the big focus now, but what when you draw off your 29 years of experience there from the engineering floor, from the manufacturing floor, how is that driving your current outlook as CEO?
Well, when I look at the pace of innovation, that is probably where I spend the most amount of my time thinking about things. We have 130 different people from around the world, our top managers, coming in next week for a planning session. And we're going to be talking a lot about the pace of innovation and how that affects our products. It doesn't just affect the boardroom type of products that we were talking about, but, you know, spectrum becomes an increasingly valuable commodity around the world. So even for our products that are going on stage that, you know, people rely on, you know, you're talking about venues that have thousands of people using cell phones and crowded spectrum. So how do our products become more intelligent? We do have products that will sense if there's a lot of interference in an arena and be able to move to frequencies where there's a little bit more free space to be moving around. But that's intelligence in our products that didn't exist 10 years ago. Products need to be connected. They need to be networked. There's, like I said earlier, there's a lot more software heading into products. So we need to be constantly thinking about the cutting edge. And so we think about that internally, but another avenue that we have is increasingly to use outside partners to help us think about the things that maybe we don't see that are happening in other industries that might apply, or things that could be hitting us a little bit sideways that, you know, maybe we don't always have the time to be thinking about. So we're trying to use our own internal brains to figure out what's happening as technology is shifting so quickly beneath our feet, but then also people on the outside that can kind of help us with new technologies emerging that we wouldn't probably find on our own.
What would be an example of that? What, like a partnership, outside partnership that you're talking about?
So we work closely with a Chicago-based company called TechNexus, and they're a company, they're a little bit of an incubator hub. They also connect companies like Shure with startups that we would not have any visibility, any line of site to at all. So we'll make connections. We can make minority investments in these companies to see if they have a technology that maybe is appropriate for what we're trying to bring to market in the future. When I was talking about the ceiling arrays earlier and having 120 mic elements in those kind of products, we are, through different investments, looking at some companies that can help even upgrade that kind of technology that we're not necessarily going to work on ourselves inside, but we're going to find partners to help us with on the outside. We're reaching that point in technology where we simply can't do it all ourselves.
And it's also sort of, and other companies are having this same issue, the disruption aspect of business. It sounds like that's an antidote to disruption, is to sort of go out there and find it before it comes to you.
You have to be as proactive as possible. And, you know, Shure has a long history, you know, 93 years now of bringing new technologies to market. Not to say that there haven't been setbacks along the way. We were talking a little bit earlier about turntables when Shure was in the phonograph needle business, cartridge business, and having a setback when CD players came onto the market. So companies have to continue to kind of reinvent themselves and adapt to changing technologies. But as much as we can do a scan of what's happening from a technology perspective, like I said, internally and externally, I think that external component's important. You know, our engineers have a lot of passion and they want to do a lot of cool things themselves. And sometimes it's hard to ask for help. But companies like ours need to do that increasingly. We can't possibly know everything.
How do you grade yourself, your job as CEO? Is it looking at earnings? Did your revenue was up 10% from 1 year over to the next? Is that the gauge, or how do you how do you view that?
Well, so I, first of all, I'm a very hard grader on myself, but the revenue number that you just cited is a little bit on the low side. Our company's been growing at really strong double digits for the last couple of years. So that is healthy, and I certainly grade myself on that. The one thing that Mr. and Mrs. Shure, as founders of the company, were always kind of banging into our heads was profitability. You can grow that top line, but you've got to keep making profits. We're a private company. Those profits get fed back into the company to keep, you know, to keep the company moving forward and being able to employ people around the world, be a good corporate citizen, living up to our core values. So all of those elements kind of play in. Are we growing? Are we creating jobs? Are we creating value for our customers? Those are all the things that, I look at.
There was recently in California, the governor signed a bill into law that requires companies there to have more women on boards, to have more women in the boardroom. You have a unique role as a female CEO. There's not a lot of those. We need more of them, obviously. What would you, what would your answer be to having more diversity, especially women in the boardroom?
Well, I've studied this both from women in the boardroom as well as, you know, STEM in general. So I've had a couple of talks in the past about how do you get girls interested in science and technology at a younger age? It's really difficult because a lot of them will make up their mind by the time they're in seventh or eighth grade. And if somehow technology isn't viewed as being cool, or, you know, you can say the same thing about management. If that somehow isn't viewed as being a field that they want to go into, you're done by the time they maybe get into high school, and certainly done by the time they get into college. So it is about increasing the pool of people. I think because of the fact that technology is becoming such an important part of so many different companies, the technology route is important to get more women into the boardroom. And so I really think it does start with getting girls more interested in all the STEM classes earlier in their school lives.
Whenever we have a CEO and we like to ask him, because I'm sure you interact with CEOs of other companies, what you're seeing out there, what's the landscape look like for not only business, but the economy, for employment, that sort of thing. What would be your report card on that?
Yeah, I belong to a couple of different networking groups. I would say right now the vibe is very positive for companies in the Chicagoland area. A lot of them, of course, like us, do business internationally. They are seeing strong growth. And they all have the same sort of issues that they're working on as Shure does, which is how do we keep pace? You know, the digital revolution is happening so quickly around us. How do our products stay relevant? What is Internet of Things, you know, machine learning, AI? What do all these things mean to our products? And products, like I was describing earlier with microphones, they have to be smarter. They network to other, you know, products, say for us in an audio chain. It's not just about making a great piece of hardware anymore. It is about making products truly smarter. So everybody's worried about keeping pace. I think that's the biggest thing on CEOs' minds right now.
Do you have a routine as a CEO that you do every morning? I know some CEOs come in and say that they make sure that they do this or that in the morning. Some people make sure they make their bed. Other people go go rowing in the river or on the lake. What is your routine? And give us a sense of why that's important as you, as a CEO.
Well, in all honesty, I really don't have a routine because my job does take me on the road quite a bit. I'm flying out to somewhere tomorrow. Next week, I described the strategy session that we're having. A couple weeks after that, I'll be going to our German facility. So every week brings something different. I do like to ground myself every morning with daily reports. You know, how were shipments yesterday? What's happening with customer delivery? Kind of the basic sort of metrics of how the company is humming along. And because we are international, when I come in the morning, there's going to be some messages that came in overnight from Asia or maybe parts of Europe. So just kind of making sure I understand what's happening today. Even if I'm traveling, I'll look at my phone and figure out, you know, okay, how are things going today? How were shipments yesterday? The basics. Just to ground myself every single day. But every day, every week truly is something different.
The employees that work for you, they must have a really cool job. I mean, it sounds like a place of innovation. Mm-hmm. And not only that, the wonderful part of it is, at least from my looking in, the importance that you've placed on history, of the history of the company, remembering mm-hmm. where you guys came from.
Yeah.
Have you had a hard time finding people in this job market? Is it a tight job for you to find the right people?
Well, right now the job market is certainly tight. I think the one thing that is the most exciting about our business is the passion that people have for our products. So if you were to do a Venn diagram between musicians at Shure and Shure engineers, that overlap would be very large. People are not just making our products and designing them, they're also using them. So there is a lot of passion into what we put into the products. A lot of critics too, a lot of internal critics certainly, yeah. But the team that I have in our executive staff, again, very motivated, very cross-functional, a very diverse group as well. And everybody has that passion for the legacy that we have, like you said, the history and having these rugged, reliable products that people go to. And to me, it's as much about the products as it is about the people that I described. The people that have this passion want to make sure solutions are working for those ultimate end users.
Well, Chris, it's wonderful meeting you. All the best to everybody at Shure, and thank you for coming in.
Great being here. Thank you.
Chris Scheivink is the CEO of Shure. You can find them online at Shure.com. We're going to continue our conversation after the bell with Chris Scheivink of Shure, and we'll post more of that in the podcast of the opening bell a little bit later on this morning.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us in our Monday edition of the opening bell. The global market for male grooming products is booming. It's projected to reach nearly $61 billion by 2020. According to Euromonitor, that's the global market, it's already valued at nearly $17.5 billion. In the U.S., maybe even 20 million, according to some estimates these days. We thought we would bring in this morning Anthony Kayyum, the president of the Shops at MERS, and to talk a little bit about this. Of course, MERS Apothecary, historic landmark destination in Chicago since 1875. So we're very excited to talk about this today with Anthony. Anthony, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate you having me.
Everybody, I think, is familiar with MERS. You have decided to expand a little bit. Let's see, there's the location of MERS up in Lincoln Park in the one downtown, and now there's the Shops at MERS. Tell us about this.
Yeah, sure. So our flagship store in Lincoln Square is MERS Apothecary, and you know, as you mentioned, we've been in business since 1875. About 4 years ago, we decided to really, we wanted to see, we saw the men's business growing, and we realized we had one of the best selections in the country that we had been working on of shaving, grooming, beard care, you name it, just about everything for men's grooming. And we decided to take it up a notch and let the world know that. So we started a brand that was sort of based on my brothers and myself called Q Brothers. We had been doing videos online and getting a lot of attention for them. And we really focused on seeing if we could make a world-class selection. And I think we did that. We've been acknowledged it by GQ and other publications as one of the best store openings in the world. So that was under the Q Brothers brand. And it was really exciting, and we were getting a lot of attention. And we literally have every day men coming in on their way and out of town from business trips saying, I heard you have the best selection of men's products anywhere. So it's been fun to watch that happen. But then what we decided to do is to see if we could do something for everyone and take the beauty and fragrance business, fragrance for men and women, especially focused on independent fragrance, and then the beauty business, meaning skincare and makeup, up to that world-class level as well. And that's what we've done with the Shops at MERS, which we officially opened this past week. And we're excited to get everyone in there, continue having men come in, but hopefully bring a new clientele that is maybe not, doesn't realize that there is a whole new world of beauty and fragrance out there that is kind of reaching a new mainstream level.
Congratulations, by the way, on the success. It's always nice to have people coming off the street and say, "Hey, I thought you were the. I hear you're the best." That must be the best for you to hear. I wanted to talk to you about, because I mentioned some stats going in to our interview at the beginning about all how many billions this is growing. I found one other note too about how it is brick and mortar, not necessarily online, where most of these sales are happening. Do you find that that's the case? Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, we've been lucky. We have an online presence, a significant online presence, both on our own site, which is smallflower.com. That's our e-commerce brand, and on Amazon. But I would say the exciting part is brick and mortar in this industry. You know, we're in a specialty portion of the industry, and it is huge and it is growing. And I think that you know, unlike many other industries where brick and mortar maybe is really on the downturn, I think that when you have an area that is sensorial, so either people want to touch the products, try them on, feel them, and requires expertise, that's a great combination for brick and mortar at a time when maybe you don't hear much good news about brick and mortar, you know? So that is the case. And we really have focused on bringing expertise to our stores. So we have a makeup artist, we have a fragrance expert, esthetician, a pharmacist, an aromatherapist. So our whole thing is that, you know, you're going to get a level of service that you cannot find necessarily just going online.
Yeah, it's hard to scratch and sniff something too in a magazine and know that that's what you want. It's good to go. And you mentioned something earlier, independent fragrances. Talk to us a little bit about that. I mean, what does that encompass, and why is that so popular?
Yeah, sure. You know, I think a lot of people, when I'm a fragrance junkie, and this is an area that that's especially close to my heart. I think a lot of people think of fragrances as a department store counter that you run through so that you don't get sprayed or accosted, you know, as you pass through. And really, that fragrance is, I mean, it may still be large, but I think the exciting part of fragrance is that there are independent producers and small niche brands that are doing fragrance that is not department store fragrance. The idea is putting much more effort into the ingredients and quality of the fragrance, and it's focused less on sort of selling you based on the celebrity behind it or the brand name, and having you find something, whoever you are, man, woman, it doesn't really matter, find something that will be one of a kind and really make you feel like, that's how I want to smell. And so that's been the driving force behind the industry, and I think it started out as something that was really a tiny part of the fragrance industry, but it is actually the fastest-growing part of the fragrance industry, and it's we're seeing right now independent companies being either bought up or attempted to be bought up by these mainstream brands as they recognize that people want something exciting and different, and maybe the mainstream fragrance has sort of gotten to a place that isn't very intriguing anymore.
Anthony, what have been the challenges of marketing MERS? I know that you mentioned earlier you had some great press in GQ, and others have written about you as well. But what are the challenges, and how have you managed to make it successful?
You know, the challenge is really just letting people know everything that we do, because we've been in business so long and we cover, you know, we're health, natural, personal care, beauty, fragrance, men's grooming. I think part of it is getting people in and letting them realize that, wow, you have all of these different things that you can offer, and that we have expertise. So I think what we've done is we've focused on telling that story through social media, through videos. I think the videos have been really great for us. We've been doing a lot of YouTube videos under our Small Flower e-commerce brand, so it's called Small Flower TV, and we're able to do product reviews and educational videos. So my brother and I did a wet shaving 101, like how to shave with a brush and a safety razor, and that has you know, hundreds of thousands of views. It's been a while since I've looked at the exact count. But I think that that's a great way to do it because, honestly, we did that video years ago, and people are still discovering it. And when I'm in the store, I'll still have guys come in and say, hey, I just watched your shaving video. And so I think that that's to us, that seems like an exciting way to market it because it's not about sort of a quick press release and then it's done. It's saying, how can we sort of form a relationship where people know to come to us and ask us questions?
What are the demographics like? Is it a younger clientele that's driving the push forward here, or does it span all of the different age groups?
I think it spans. For us, we're noticing all the different age groups. I think it's different parts of what we do are appealing to different people. I would say that the fragrance and cosmetic skews slightly younger than like the health and personal care area of our business. But I would say still it's not a youth-driven business. I would say, mid-20s through mid-40s, probably for the fragrance business it's the primary customer. But I wouldn't say that there's any really one group. We have customers. There was a customer in last week. She was 97 years old and has been shopping with us forever. And came in and got her makeup done with one of these new clean beauty brands that we are offering. And it was a fun day for us in the store to see someone kind of, of that age tuned into what's going on at the younger, hip end of the market.
Very cool. So, Anthony, again, it's the shops at MERS. How can we find it again? Where do we go? Give us all the particulars.
Yeah, sure. MERZApothecary.com. That's MERZ. Apothecary is our website. We have a store in Lincoln Square, and the shops at MERZ is adjoined and adjacent to that. We have MERZ downtown at the Palmer House main entrance on Monroe. And our e-commerce business is smallflower.com.
All right. Very good of you to be with us this morning. Congratulations again on your success, and please come back and join us sometime.
Yeah, I would love to. Thank you, Steve. Have a great day.
You too. Anthony Kayyem is the president of the shops at MERS. It's MERS Apothecary.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward opening losses later this morning on Wall Street. Dow futures are down 89 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures off about a quarter to a third. Now, agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Ori and Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. The big news, if it comes true tomorrow, is that President Trump is expected to announce the lifting of a federal ban on summer sales of higher ethanol blends of gasoline. He'll be in Iowa tomorrow, and according to two sources, will be making the announcement there at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And the lifting of the summer ban on so-called E15 gasoline is expected to be coupled with restrictions on trading biofuel credits that underpin the program. And then World Dairy Expo, Saturday afternoon. For only the second time in World Dairy Expo's 52-year history, the supreme champion of the Junior Show and the supreme champion of World Dairy Expo are the same cow. Exhibited by Kyle Barton of New York, the grand champion Brown Swiss, and the 2018 supreme champion of the Junior Show. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for Monday, October 8th. No major economic or business reports scheduled today. It is stock market is open today, but it's a bond market holiday. Through the week, Google hardware event tomorrow, some new stuff being announced. On Thursday, the earnings calendar picks up again. Delta, Walgreens Boots Alliance. Also on Friday, Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo,
U.S. consumer sentiment numbers for October coming as well on Friday. So the calendar will pick up after a holiday today, generally a slow day today on this Monday, October the 8th.